podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield Wrap on Radio City Talk. It's very, very exciting indeed. Talk of people getting off the rails and all sorts. And it's Friday night. John Gibbons, you are Mr. Friday Night.
Speaking of off the rails.
And you must be intimidated by this chat at this stage of the evening.
I mean, to be honest, for me at this stage, the rails are a distant memory. Like, I'm aware there's rails somewhere, but I can't even reach them to hold on.
It's the rails are terrifying at this stage.
It's like a train with three coaches and... Basically, we're all off those rails. I hope my missus isn't listening to this, by the way.
Well, very much so. But, you know, Cope, you are also, Paul Cope, you're also off the rails.
Absolutely. And happy to be so, I think.
Oh, yeah, it's underrated.
I think that's the conclusion.
Yeah, people talk in hushed whispers. Oh, he's off the rails. It's absolutely great.
All right, then. If you take anything from this show, from the Anfield up this week, you want to get off the rails. It's a fabulous weekend in Liverpool. The Reds aren't even playing Saturday. You may as well just go out Friday night, Saturday night, and see how you feel Sunday morning and go from there. But we'll start off talking about Huddersfield and the Huddersfields and what you can take from the Huddersfield game. Because, John, we did the post-match show straight afterwards, and at that time, you're thinking just about that game, but not about the sort of the wider knock-on effect, the wider things that it points to, leads to, etc., etc. There's loads of little bits in there, I think. You know, when you bear in mind how many sides we're going to play, we're going to be similar, if not the same, as Huddersfield. Loads of little things the manager may well have sort of logged and gone, you know what, I'm happy how that worked.
Yeah, I think he'd be particularly happy with the midfield because a few people were looking at it and thinking, oh, it's not very inspiring, you know, it's a bit more workmanlike. Is there enough pace there? You know what I mean? It's a few solid lads, isn't it? But it controlled the game. It worked pretty well, and it gave a platform for those attacking three to prosper. And I think going to Huddersfield, I think, you know, sometimes being patient isn't the worst thing in the world. And we've got into this team for its swashbuckling style and its ability to tear teams apart, and that's been really good fun. But also in times it's looked like he did against West Brom, where you're like, what on earth's going on? They're far too open. There's gaps everywhere, and it just kind of looks a bit of a mess. And so, I think he'll be looking at James Milner, for example, as someone who I expect him to use quite a bit away from home in the league this season. I think I don't think he'll necessarily play in Europe or home games we're expected to win, but I think in league games away from home, he'll be looking at him as someone who he can use quite a bit. I thought Emre Can in a more advanced position worked really well. He obviously gets his goal, but he's generally in the game a lot. And Henderson was a real plus point coming back from injury, hitting the ground running so strongly and putting in a catch a performance. And so I think that'll really please him. It's a clean sheet. We didn't keep a clean sheet at all in January, and so apart from this game, so to get that one and to look more solid but still score three goals, I think plenty of positives.
On our review show on tour player, Paul, I sort of said, I don't feel like Henderson and Chan start that many games together. And Andrew Beasley, brilliant statistician that he is, leapt into action, and he put a little graph thing together which made clear that so far this season, I think I counted through, and it's only 13 games out of the 30 odd that we've played that Chan and Henderson have both started together. And a lot of people are desperate to sort of put them in opposition to each other so they both can't play together. And I thought that was a real example of how not just that they can both coexist in the same side, but that they can really dovetail quite nicely at times. Henderson passing it into Chan's path, knowing he can bomb on, knowing someone can sit. I that was one of the main things I took from the game.
Yeah, I've since coming off the rails, I've had some moments of clarity, so I've got some theories for you today.
Can't wait, come on, this could be wild.
One of them is a Henderson and Chan thing. If we're being nice to our footballers, which I think is what Liverpool Football Club is all about these days, just being nice to our footballers, we should sell Chan to Benitez and Henderson to Rodgers. And that's how you get the best out of them. Because Emre Can needs to be told by your manager, you're not a number six. He's brilliant. He's a brilliant footballer, but he's not a number six. And Henderson is the opposite. Klopp's desperate to make him a number six, and he should be playing further forward. So yeah, they can play brilliantly together in a team, but I think you're always going to compromise one of them. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah.
Whichever one is playing six, you're not going to get the best out of. The best we've ever seen Jordan Henderson is further forward. Mm. And I've been saying for a while
14.
Now. Exactly that.
I mean, I wonder though, Paul, with the injuries that he's had, whether he's actually capable of playing that more advanced role, which I think does involve more running. The six role, obviously, you know, you to an extent, you anchor things a little bit and you spread the play, and I think he's good at that. I mean, Jordan Henderson's a good footballer. I know we get stick on this show.
I'd say he's a very, very good footballer.
Yeah, and Klopp himself this week has gone to war over people's perceptions of Jordan Henderson. But there's no two ways about it. In terms of fitness levels and injuries over the last 2 to 3 years, he's had a really rough time. The heel injury took loads out of him. I think took a yard of pace. And I'd like to see him back in that role further forward. I mean, he was basically the fourth forward behind Sterling, Suarez and Sturridge in 2013, which is why he got 6 or 7 goals. And there was one against Swansea, which was practically like a rugby union try, but he sort of forced it over the line. Yeah. But you're not going to see him in those positions playing where he is as a six. And I think he's got the ability to do that. And it's interesting there, though, that you know, on Tuesday night, they dovetail quite well and it looked like a partnership. And that's great. And you, Neil, you say there about, you know, you can envisage them playing together. Well, maybe in that case, if we like Henderson, we should have made more of an effort to keep Henry Chan, because he's going.
Yeah, I'm sure he can play with someone else.
Yeah, he can sort it out with someone else. I mean, that's the wider thing. But I think between now and the end of the season, John, it's something that when you were saying before about the midfield, you can see how that can function for us.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, look, if people want to say to me that Emre Can doesn't want to play with Henderson, well, he looked perfectly happy in midweek. You know, he looked.
Getting the ball early,
yeah,
stuff
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. It just looked liberated to me. He was getting about the pitch. He was looking to attack. I mean, he gets his goal, which always helps any footballer. And I think, you know, your tail's going to be up when you've rifled one in from outside the box, albeit with a little nick. But I think, you know, he looked to me like perfectly happy to have a bit kind of less pressure on. I think taking Wijnaldum out was right. I thought he hasn't had a great little time. He plays really well against Manchester City, which he always seems to. But apart from that, not in the best form. But I thought the three of them did really well and have given certainly the manager a real option away from home in the league.
Next one on the line that struck me, Mike, was Mane seemed to be higher up the pitch, seemed to be mm-hmm. playing more like a forward, more like he's trying to get in at times, almost like a central striker.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if this season the manager's had one eye on, you know, can he be a bit more of an attacking midfielder for me? Whereas, one of the things I take from that game is just let him play. Just let him play as high up the pitch as possible. Liberate him completely, push high, and let him play high.
I think the thing about Mane is that he's unselfish in the sense that he's willing to come deep and get the ball and attack from deeper positions, but I don't think it's his forte because he's got incredible pace. He's very, very direct. And his ideal position for me is the position that he scored that great goal against Manchester City, just on the edge of the penalty area. That's where all strikers operate. You can't be any further forward than that because you're liable to be offside. That's the danger territory. And when Liverpool are at the best and in games where they've got the licence to play and they've got a little bit of space, it's the interchanging between Firmino, who'll nominally operate the central position, and Mane swapping and Salah moving across the line and always coming in on his left foot from the right hand side, that gives Liverpool this fluid three that can cause opposition's absolute nightmares. If we can just go back to one point that John made there about Wijnaldum, I expect to see Wijnaldum play tomorrow because the game is tailored, it's a typical Wijnaldum game. He always plays well in late games against good opposition at Anfield when there's a bit of a noise. And I could probably name 6 or 7 examples, but equally I could name 6 or 7 examples where he just does absolutely nothing. He's completely invisible, and that's either on a quiet day at Anfield or away from home.
I'd argue the 6 or 7 examples from this season, across his two seasons.
Yeah.
And that's sort
he's
of...
really hard to work out, and, you know, that might be deemed a criticism. I actually find it just more interesting, to be honest with you, because I'd love to get to the bottom of it.
Isn't this funny? Because I actually don't think he is hard to figure out. I remember having an argument to people before we signed, and people like, well, he scored 11 goals at home last season. He didn't score away from home. And I was like,
and he's done the same with Liverpool.
Well, we'll just play him at home.
Yeah.
We haven't got a midfielder who's scoring 11 goals at home. So just play him at home in big games.
Yeah.
Done.
Well, but
the
on
arch pragmatist there, Cope.
But on that, I mean, that throws open. There's 13 games to go, Paul, and 10 of those games are against the current bottom 11 this season. And it's easy to focus on the Spurs game that's coming, and then we've got United in March, second to last game of the season against Chelsea, so it feels further away. But we can get all completely het up that they're absolute defining factors. The reality is that if we win our 10 games against the bottom 11 that are left, that's 80 points. Now, we won't do that because football's football, but it is, you know, ensuring how we get as much of them as much out of those games as humanly possible. If, you know, that's what's going to actually make the difference on this top four thing.
Yeah, and one of those things is, and it sounds flippant this, but don't play Gini Wijnaldum. Don't play him. That midfield against those defences just doesn't work. And going back to my theories off the rails and stuff, I had a moment of clarity this week and thought, look at our last 20 games, and this, you can either look at this positively or negatively. Don't think they're that different, all of them. Take out the City game because it's a bit of an anomaly because you're not going to play games like that. Swansea and Huddersfield, the difference between those two games is they both get one chance. Swansea score, Huddersfield don't. And then against Huddersfield, we score a goal from the edge of the box. And after that, everything seems great. I watched the first half an hour of that game again before. It's absolutely no different to Swansea. We didn't do anything. Nothing. They had a chance from 10 yards out and hit it straight at our keeper, not in the bottom corner. That's it. That's the difference. And it sounds easy to say, but
yeah, and
the point
and that's
is
the way
take your chances.
Absolutely, and that, you know, that defines football matches,
yeah,
doesn't 100%. It? But then what happened, and where Liverpool are weak against Swansea City is that when that happens and they concede, they have this inability to actually do what they did against Huddersfield for the rest of the game. So, and this all points to that mental frailty that people have been people have been going on this about this mental frailty of the players under Jurgen Klopp ever since he came in, haven't they? They said there's no character, there's no bottle. And I'll go to the well with this one. It's the manager's responsibility to address mental frailty, to either boost up those lads to improve that mental attitude, or to ship them out and get lads in who've got it innate.
I think he knows that's his job. Like.
I think absolutely. But when criticism falls on players, and let's face it, there are targets for this abuse that I don't have to name. Everyone knows who we're talking about, and yet most of them are either still playing or still at the club.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's going to have to make a decision on a few going forward in terms of the inconsistencies, and that's the biggest difference between coming third and fourth and coming first and second is the not what your best performance is. It's how many of them you can deliver in
the
season.
Totally.
And I think with a lot of these lads we've talked about, you know, Emery Chan, Gini Wijnaldum,
Dejan Lovren.
Lovren, even arguably Henderson, who we've been talking about as well. It's okay, well, how many, we know you, what your great performances looks like, how many of those can you deliver in a season?
I think this is the definition of a quality player. Every single player in the world has an off day, even Messi has an off day. I know that really few and far between. The definition of a quality player is someone who can deliver 9 times in 10. The definition of a good player is someone who can deliver 7 times in 10. And the definition of an average player is someone who does that 5 times out of 10. And we've got too many players who look great half the time and look terrible half the time. And I think they're all good footballers, don't get me wrong. And on any given day, you could scout any of them and think, do you know what, he's a great lad, him. And then you can speak to him and think, do you know what, he's intelligent and he's got the right attitude as well. But ultimately, the only test case is out on the field, and particularly at Anfield, I think, in front of that crowd.
But it's also the way in which they work together, Paul, and that's what I think when we started on this one, because my difference between Swansea and Huddersfield is how quickly Liverpool move the ball. It's a noticeable difference, and you can say it's just confidence, but I don't think it is. I think it's players working in harmony with each other and being quick. And yeah, almost certainly there is a confidence factor, but I think it's more than just that. I think it is a tactical thing, and it's about how people slot into what their role actually is, and not trying to make them do something that's alien to them, or trying to get them to play with someone who just doesn't suit them.
I think that's right, but I also think it comes down to players themselves, and there's no denying, for all the people who hate him, as Mike was saying earlier, you put Jordan Henderson in your midfield, he comes on against West Brom, what's the first thing he does? He starts passing the ball forward early. That's what he does. Quickly, first touch, one touch passes. All of a sudden, you're watching our midfield playing one touch passes, and that just doesn't happen when it's Chan and Wijnaldum in there. It just doesn't happen. They're chewing the ball, and you can't afford to have that. Once you've got Henderson on the pitch, he, whether people like this or not, he makes those around him look better. Going back to the playing with Chan point, when Henderson's not there, no one's drilling the ball into Chan's feet. No one else is doing that. And all of a sudden, that is the one difference actually from Huddersfield to Swansea. Even Matip, noticeably after 2 minutes, was drilling the ball through midfield. And that was an instruction, clearly.
Okay, this is the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson, Paul Cope, and Mike Nevin and John Gibbons. In a minute or two, we're going to have a chat about our Moments in Time project. It is the Anfield Wrap, Radio City Talk, Paul Cope, Mike Nevin and John Gibbons. Really pleased to have John with us today. I want to talk about the project he's been working on for the last few weeks and months for the Anfield Wrap. His Moments in Time project, the first of which was about the day in which Kenny Dalglish resigned as Liverpool manager in 1991. And John, do you want to give a quick pressy of it to people who are listening and may not have heard it yet?
Yeah, so the idea is that it's it's eyewitness accounts of big moments in Liverpool's history. So obviously, you guys, I mean, you and Mike, who are in the room, do a great job of telling the stories of these seasons that we do on Tour Player, what we call history, and they're really great. But I had an idea that I'd like to just get under the fingernails, if you like, of certain days, certain incidents. It might be a game of football, it might be a transfer, or might in this case be a resignation, and just get the stories of the people who were there at the time. Because I know a lot of the people who listen to the Anfield Wrap are either younger fans, a lot of people who work for the Anfield Wrap are kind of younger fans, and also around the world, people who might have got into Liverpool more recently. I spoke to one guy who's over from America at the moment, who only started supporting us in 2013-14, and so, you know, people who we might have heard these stories but won't know too much about them. So rather than our voices, it's the voices of people who were around. So for the Kenny one, for example, we've got a couple of players, Bruce Gobelaar and Glenn Hussein, who was captain in the 4-4 game 2 days before the resignation. We've got lots of journalists who work in the patch at the time, guys like Brian Reid, who was at the Echo, and also Henry Winter, who wrote his autobiography. So he's spoke to Kenny about this probably more than anyone, because what you get from that is Kenny doesn't really talk about it. Family members, got Kelly Cates to do it, which was really generous of her. And then fans as well, because obviously the Anfield Wrap will always be a fan-led organisation, so why would you tell any story about Liverpool's history without involving fan voices as well? So Mike kindly got involved, guys like Rob Gutman and really good writers like John Machen and Kev Samo, who have been season ticket holders since before I was born. So got a lot of passion in there. People were really generous with themselves, with what they gave, and it's come together really nicely. I surprised myself.
I haven't listened to it in full yet, purely because I want to sit down and enjoy it and have time, but I've listened to some of it, and the production of it is absolutely outstanding. It really is. And you know, you can have the voices are great, I mean, that goes without saying, but the way that it's produced, it's top quality audio, basically, in my opinion. And they're certainly privileged to have been a very small part of it. And it was interesting that John talked about younger people that wanted to learn about that. But it's not just younger people. My dad texted me saying he'd listened to it, and my dad was 70 a few weeks ago, and just said how much he'd enjoyed it and how it reminded me of something that was very, very sad, and, you know, sort of cataclysmic, really, for Liverpool. Because in my opinion, we've never quite recovered from Dalglish resigning, and we've never quite recovered from Hillsborough, which was the catalyst of Dalglish's resignation. And I've written something to sort of bolster John's incredible piece of work there today, which will be out on the site when I can find some internet connection before I go back off the rails.
John, the cataclysmic part is the bit which I think it's put over really well. I think it's two things. It's a love letter, not by you, and that's what's really interesting, but by the contributors towards Kenny, and that includes the journalists as well.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that it is. And the second thing that it is that it really throws into focus the idea that this was, insofar as, and it's a different time, with the way which football's discussed back then, but, like, you know, in a nationwide sense, this was huge and cataclysmic and wrecked everyone's head.
Yeah, just to touch on your first point, I came away from all these interviews, and I think I said it to you quite a few times, like, these people just adore Kenny Dalglish, like, they absolutely adore him, and you expect that from supporters. Like, I know Rob Gutman loves Kenny, you know what I mean, but, and I know Mike does, but, you know, you go and see Clive Tilsley, and he just thinks he's brilliant, and not just him, but Marina Dalglish is brilliant, and the whole family are great, and they just think he's the greatest man who's ever walked the planet, and they might have a point. And you know, all that, Henry Winter just has done two books with him, and Henry Winter must have met and interviewed every football manager, you know, a notable one in the country, if not across Europe as well, and just, you know, thinks the absolute world of the man. And when it's laid out in terms of what he did for the football club and the city, you know, it's kind of hard to argue with, really, and it's laid out really well. As you say, in other voices, I barely talk on it, and that's the way I'd like them all to be, really, because it's people telling, they're telling the stories, and it's lovely, it's heartwarming, but there's hopefully new stuff in there for everyone as well, even people like Mike says, who kind of live through it, because the people maybe are happier to tell stories now with a bit of distance.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
What Kelly says at the end, not to give too much away, is that she feels like she can be more open about it now because Kenny went back, and it finishes with Kenny going back and that lovely moment. And yeah, she says it's closure for him now, and so they can.
He won a trophy.
And he won a trophy. Yeah.
It was a nice way to bookend things. I just want to make one point about it, and that that I've actually mentioned this in my piece today, which incidentally arose in the Beehive in town, and it took me 45 minutes, 1,000 words, the quickest article I've ever read. It was all in there. It was triggered by a glass of wine, I must say. But the thing, when Dalglish was a player, I remembered him in his first part of his Liverpool career as a very young lad of 11 and 12, and then I sort of grew up with him. And when Liverpool do the double ultimately in 86, I think I'm 17 or 18. But in 84, 85, and you're seeing this dying light basically of Kenny Dalglish, and you're thinking, you know, time's catching up with him and he's not going to be here forever. And then they pull this masterstroke of making him manager, and you think, do you know what, we've got him forever now. Because we've had Shankly, we've had Paisley, and we've had Fagan, and they go on till they're 65. So at the age of 35, I'm envisaging 30 more years of being able to lay my eyes on Kenny Dalglish from the cop. Or he'll have a trackie on instead of the red kit. Eventually he'll have his book. I'm spoiling my article here for everyone. You won't have to read it now. So this notion that we were going to see Dalglish for the rest of our lives, basically, was just so comforting. And therein lies the tragedy, really, is that we only got 6 years of him as manager. And that's why, you know, it's so important that he got the chance to come back, albeit for 2 years. And I'm still sad about the way he was treated at the end. I think the way that he was fired after winning our last trophy was a disgrace.
How do people listen to it?
You can go to theanfieldrap.com. It's the feature story on there. There's a player on there that IT Matt's built, so you just have to press play, or you can listen to it through our app. So there's tour subscribers. So if you subscribe to Tour Play, it'll be there. It'll be there ready for you to listen to. Or if you don't, but you want to listen to it through an app, it's on iTunes and all that, and through all the podcast apps that people listen to it. So do give it a listen, and do also share it amongst people, because we're keen to get it out there as much as possible. Not just because we're really proud of it and we think it's really good and people enjoy it, but also we're keen this year to kind of, and this is a bit behind the fourth wall, but in terms of just to show off more what groups of fans can do. And I think there's sometimes an idea that fan content is you know, people shouting outside stadiums just after the game that the manager's got to go, and it's all a bit kind of bedroom and it's all thrown together and it's all ranty, whereas there's no reason why groups of supporters, be that us or any of the other fantastic fan media groups around the country, can't put together stuff like this.
Basically, I mean, to me it's like a documentary.
It is a documentary.
I'm fascinated to know what's coming next, because I mean, as a concept,
you played a coy, John.
You don't have to worry it, but I mean, I don't have to worry it. I'm not worried.
John is, you know, because he feels as though he's not half gone big and heavy on the first one.
He's gone in with the biggest.
Honestly, the amount of people who message me saying, "You've set the bar high here," and I was like, "Yeah, I know."
Yeah. Don't have to tell me, mate.
Yeah. Yeah.
All I can say,
I'm not sleeping nights.
I should have done a genie when Adam threw in a 6 out of 10 earlier.
It's absolutely fantastic. If you can listen to it, do so. Moments in Time, and it isn't the last one. Hopefully there'll be 6 of them across the course of the year. I will ruin that little bit for you. Yeah. John's working really, really hard on them. I want to mention one more thing before we get to 7 o'clock, and then before we speak to Robin Byland from Sweden about his supporting past. There's a guy called Paul Rowe who's got in touch with us, and it's about his beloved Flatiron Reds flag, which went missing from the Flatiron on the day of the Man City game. If it's black, it's red and red and white chevrons, squares like the classic Croatia kit, and it's been signed by ex players, and it's been all the way around Europe. If you know where it is, know anything about it, give us a shout at the Anfield Raps Twitter, and we'll put you in touch with Paul and sort that out. If we can get that back to him, that will be fantastic. This is the Anfield Rap on Radio City Talker. After the break, we're going to start to look ahead to Spurs, and before then, we're going to have a quick trip to Sweden. It is the Anfield Rap on Radio City Talk. We'll be back with Paul, Mike and John in a minute or two. But earlier, well, yesterday, in fact, I spoke to Robin Byland in a feature that we're going to start doing, which is looking at supporters clubs around the world and other supporter media from around the world, and tracing what their love of Liverpool stems from and how it also gets they get to demonstrate it as well. So I had a chat to Robin, and we also obviously got onto the Spurs game. It's LFC Podden. This is Robin Byland.
Yep. Welcome back to Radio City Talk. Neil Atkinson here with Robin Byland from LFC Podden. in Sweden. And what we're going to try and do is, between now and the end of the season, look at the different ways in which Liverpool are supported around the globe, take the opportunity to do so, certainly on occasional weeks, and have those conversations, really. Because for me, one of the most interesting things, having done the Anfield Wrap, is sort of seeing a diaspora of Liverpool supporters. We're off to Sweden in a few weeks, and we will always report back. But Robin, you've been doing the pod now for some time, and what's the general sort of feeling in Sweden towards Liverpool? I think I'm of the view we're a very big club there, and that Swedish football very much revolves around the Premier League, and Liverpool are as big as anybody else.
Yeah, just as you say, first and foremost, Premier League in general is huge in Sweden. When first football came to the televisions, it was English football, and that was pretty much what you could watch, a game every now and then, once a month or something. We have the supporters of Wolves, Ipswich, and of course Liverpool was huge in the 70s and 80s when this really triggered and took down to the general public in terms of that. And of course with the success that Liverpool team had, and then also if we look back to the late 80s, early 90s with Glenn Hussein, who came in, Liverpool got something extra as well for Swedes. And at the moment now, we've seen the Manchester United in the 90s, we've seen the Chelsea's, the Manchester City, but as a supporters union, there's nothing that compares to Liverpool in Sweden.
Why do you think that is? What do you think it is that sustains Liverpool in this sense? It's something I'm going to want to get to grips with as I'm talking to different people around this, because as you just pointed out there, you know, Chelsea have won however many league titles since 2004. Manchester United have been successful, relentlessly successful, really, since 1992. Manchester City are on the scene now, and yet wherever you go in the world, and Sweden, yep, you know, you're saying is another example of it, Liverpool remain close to people's hearts and close to their consciousness as well. It's like there's two or three big clubs in England, and Liverpool seem to be perpetually one of them to everybody.
Yeah, and it's, I think, the easy way to put it is, it's just what the club is about. The same things I think that you see from a Liverpool perspective and from all over England with fans there, and also for supporters around the globe. We haven't been spoiled with success on the pitch, but there is something special, the myth around the club, that you never walk alone, and all that. And it's very easy, I think, for supporters here, when you have the distance. You cannot go there every now and then. You cannot go every week. But to know that all the atmosphere around it is that you're a part of my club. You're a part of this club. As long as you cheer for us, you cry with us, you're a Liverpool fan. And I think you Liverpool fans in general, wherever I go and meet them as well, there's something special to it. Maybe also even more during the last couple of years where success on the pitch haven't been as big as we've hoped. There's, I think, all of those off the pitch things have been even...
Yeah,
have been even bigger to prove to other supporters, maybe as well, to show, okay, we haven't won the title, but hey, we're Liverpool. We gather 500 people to watch a game together, have the beers, have the laughters, which you don't have. So I think that's been a strength.
Bit of strength sort of across Sweden in there and around Stockholm and places like that. On all of that, you know, it's very much a live thing, and this is what I want to put over it. It's not former glories, and right now it's, you know, Liverpool have got an exciting side to watch. The frustrations, I'm sure, the same frustrations I had with Liverpool supporters everywhere around things like the transfer window and how that's gone. But is there a, you know, you're saying that there's numbers and numbers of people coming together to watch Liverpool. Is there a genuine buzz about this season in Sweden?
I think so, and I think it's been a general buzz pretty much since Jürgen Klopp came in. A lot of Swedes have actually quite a close relationship to the German football as well.
Okay.
We like it at least a lot, the structure, I think everything around it. So Jürgen Klopp was a big name in Sweden as well. I bet that 8 out of 10 probably was standing up to scream his name when Liverpool hired him. And no, it's been a big bust since Liverpool. But of course, as you say, the same frustration. Players, we start to maybe reach that goal, maybe reach all the way to the top. Now we sold Coutinho, and of course you've dragged between the highs and the lows, but there is a bus that which haven't been there. Of course, the 13-14 season aside, which was something extraordinary, but otherwise I think this Liverpool side with the type of players as well is a Liverpool side that a lot of fans have taken to the heart.
What's the looking forward then to this game on Sunday, which I'm sure will have them packed out in the bars that you go to because it's such a massive game.
Yeah.
What are you expecting from it from Liverpool? I'm going to ask you for a prediction, but I'm not going to ask you for it straight away. How are you expecting the game to play out?
I actually expect Jurgen Klopp to play it the same way he's done 9 out of 10 times in those occasions. We saw the Manchester City game at home. I think we'll see something like it. It do scares me because I think we all saw how Spurs took down Manchester United quite easy when Mourinho for once didn't sit as low as he normally do. We saw it at Wembley against Spurs in the away game earlier. But I don't think we have the nor the mentality or tactics to go and sit deep and try to be calm. It will be a party and a mess all over, and hopefully we'll come out on top.
It'll be a party and a mess indeed. Give me a prediction.
1-1, and I'll be happy with that.
1-1, and you'll take the point, my word, Robin. Come on, let's get some front foot in you. Let's give it the big one. Listen, it is fantastic to have Robin join us there from LFC Pod and at LFC Pod and on Twitter. You can find the Swedish Pod there. It is a pleasure to have him here. This is the Anfield Rap on Radio City Talk. We'll be back just after this.
Great to speak to Robin there. Get back over in a second or two for Mike, Paul and John. But before then, these are Run DMC and this is Walk This Way. Mike Nevin, John Gibbons here with me to discuss the Reds Bet specials this week and in general, whatever you might be looking at. If you are going to gamble, do so with Reds Bet if you can for us. That'd be fantastic. And if you're not going to gamble, you're not going to gamble. Don't worry in the slightest. It's very much a personal choice and do so responsibly and enjoyably. And you've got your usual bet. You've just told me one of them's not yours. Liverpool versus Tottenham. Sadio Mane to score a hat-trick, 100-1. Mane eater.
Yeah, I've actually, it's a nice one, isn't it? But it's not my work. I can't plagiarise. I've backed it. I've had a tenner on it. Probably bankrupt my own company. It's a fun bet, isn't it? That's the whole point of these specials. It's just about, sort of having a wager on a big price if you want to. But if you want to make a more considered gamble and Liverpool to win or Spurs to win or whatever you think, then, every single option is out there. Plus the horses and the snooker and the darts.
It's all there. Liverpool versus Tottenham, when Harry met Salah.
Yeah. Oh, like it. Is that what yours?
Sort of. I'm outsourcing.
It's
Maguire. Hey! Cheers, Chris, if you're listening.
Salah to score from outside the box.
It's a beauty, that, isn't it?
It is a beauty, when Harry met Salah.
Yeah.
What are you doing on that?
6-1.
6-1 for Salah outside the box.
Yeah.
I think it's a good bet. Think about the curlers against Everton.
Loves
the name but one. Yeah. That's actually become a trademark Salah goal, actually, that curling shot beyond the keeper.
It's good that he has that. Yeah. It's like Messi's obviously got his thing that he does, and everyone goes, why the man won't stop
definitely.
That?
Definitely.
It's on Messi.
Do you know what? Yeah. I think there's nothing more... I love goalies, as people will know from listening to me on these shows, but there's nothing better seeing a ball go beyond flailing arms.
You do love goalies, don't you? John hates them, he thinks they're not proper footballers.
No,
that's just true.
Me daughters.
So when Heaton says, hang on, when Heaton says stuff like, oh, it's like another sport and blah, 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 you go, yeah, it is, mate, a less good one.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I beg to differ. I think the world of goalkeeping is another sport. I agree with John there. I think it's a better one than the fellas who can't pick it up.
My daughter's
a goalie, so I have to say this. I'm literally in the goalkeepers' union.
there was a funny thing the other day where Mark Schwarzer was saying that basically there's not enough people on the radio or TV who know anything about goalkeeping.
Yeah, totally.
And I thought it was a fair point until you realised that Mark Schwartz is on radio all the time. So, have a go yourself.
Just trying to get his mates in.
And also, Schwartz there before ruling him out of the other 10 footballers. And he's not allowed an opinion on them anymore. Schwartz said, nah, I'm all right on them.
Probably hasn't, but yeah, he should shut up about strikers and fellas with left foot and right feet and all this, you know, yeah, definitely.
The good lads.
Yeah, well, you're not getting me on this one, Neil. Stick with the keepers, come on.
So we've got a spare tyre, which is a goal between 76 and full-time. More of a visual pun, that one, because tyre is spelt, spare is spelt like spurs, tyre is spelt like the things that go on your car.
Oh, the tyring.
Yeah. Not like the things that go on your car, sorry. Yeah, like yeah,
that's one of mine, then.
Spare tyre.
Pleased with that.
Yeah, okay.
10 to 11, that'll be a goal between the 76th and final whistle. 76th minute and the final whistle. Klopp on top there again. Liverpool to win to nil, which is actually quite a little tempter, I'd say.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I think this is a really interesting thing about the match on Sunday, is that last season, I think Liverpool won 2-0, and the game was done and dusted in the first 20. Liverpool went out massive tempo, blew Spurs away. But Pochettino played a hugely high line and really played into Liverpool's hands. It's circumstances that Liverpool do well in. You know, like a high-octane sort of late afternoon kickoff. Similarly on Sunday. I just feel that, you know, he might be inclined to be a little bit more prosaic and a little bit more defensive and not play that high line. I mean, you know, repeating mistakes is the definition of madness. He's a good manager, as is our own manager. And I think it's an intriguing battle. And I suppose that bet is set up all around now.
I think there's one here which is, I'm not tempted by, I'll be honest with you, Mike. The perfect weekend, great weekend, horrible weekend. I don't think any of them stand out to me, because I just don't see any way on earth Everton get anything from Arsenal at all.
Not even a bit of a walk-off factor. No, he scored two in the week. He looks hungry. He enjoyed his goals as well.
I enjoyed him enjoying his goals. Yeah, I think he'd celebrate if he scored, but I'm not. I just, every aspect of it, it's one of them really where you, every now and again you think Everton might do something for you.
And they never do.
And you also see the stats of Everton away from home. The stats,
especially against the big clubs.
The stats of Everton away from home against the big clubs were against the current top six in the last however many years.
I think it's interesting.
They took 17 points from a possible 128.
Yeah, and it is a shocking record. But you know, equally, if you're looking at it from odds makers, they would say you know that things eventually level themselves out, and you know that the law of averages says this, that, and the other.
At some point, they'll win one.
And I think John's point's really, really good, because you know Everton have reinvested during January, and they might get a little bit of a spare from the signing of Walcott. They got that immediate reaction in midweek when he got the two goals. So yeah, you know, and hopefully they can do us a favour, because I think with Arsenal's capture of Aubameyang, I think that could reinvigorate their season as well. And they're not a million miles away from us. And the way that the results worked out in midweek, with obviously United losing at Spurs, it's brought everyone quite close together. So you've now got a legitimate battle between, I think, five clubs. For three places, and that makes it interesting. The league, the title itself is settled for me. You know, I don't think we'd be offering any odds on City, but Betfred will have paid out by now. But he would have done if he was a City fan. And it's tight at the top, and there's, I think Liverpool got 14 games to go.
The great weekend, Liverpool win, Everton fail to win, United fail to win again. We were at Huddersfield, and those lads running around Old Trafford. I've got to be honest, I'm going.
There's a decent price on that. I think you can see that.
Forget that.
I can't see Huddersfield getting much at Old Trafford on Saturday. They were abject against Liverpool. They really were. I think they're suffering hugely from that sort of second half of the season syndrome that these promoted clubs get. They have that bounce at the start.
Stops being fun.
It does, doesn't it?
And it didn't look fun between 45 and 60 for them.
I was actually at a Huddersfield fans trust meeting last night, and they're all, you know, sort of resigned to going down, and actually quite looking forward to it, because you know they're not sort of enjoying it at the moment. They're not used to losing because they've been doing well in recent seasons, and it's taking a toll on their outlook and their enjoyment of their match day, which I found really interesting.
It is indeed. And the perfect weekend is Liverpool win, Everton lose, Man United lose. That's 40-1. Would be huge if it happens. If you're looking for the best one of them, it's probably a great weekend. Liverpool win, Everton fail to win, and Man United fail to win at 12-1, where obviously we all want the Reds to win. Don't fancy Everton at Arsenal, and United, if Huddersfield could be in with a shout on 70, you never know, they could just hang on in there. Yeah. You enjoying it, the job?
Love it, absolutely loving it, yeah. And it's all about, really, I wouldn't have taken the job. It's about the values, really, about the community, the way that we can potentially put money back into football fans' causes. I mean, that is the essence of it. 50% of net profits back into football fans' causes. If I can just speak of one case.
Yeah, of course.
Where we've got a trust signed up. It's the Sheffield United Supporters Trust, and because they've engaged with us and they want to partake in what we're doing, they've already identified two main beneficiaries for money that we can raise for them out of their losses, basically. You know, if they win, they win. If they lose, then the any losing bets go into a fund directed to Sheffield United causes. And the two causes that they've identified are tickets for underprivileged children in Sheffield to go to their first ever Sheffield United game. Free tickets, that would be, so that kids would be paid to get tickets who would ordinarily not be able to go because their families can't afford it. And alongside that, they've got what I think is a fantastic initiative, which is to restore former players' graves that have fallen into disrepair. So, you know, age-old Blades heroes.
Yeah.
And really, really sad. You know, footballers weren't paid great amounts of money. Their families never became millionaires in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, even the 70s. So their initiative with that is to do exactly that, to repair and restore former players' graves to what they deserve to be, really.
Excellent. Okay, well, if you fancy it this weekend, if you haven't yet opened an account, and as I say, if you are somebody who enjoys a week-by-week flutter, redsbet.com. Thanks very much to Mike. We'll get back over and get on with the rest of the show. That's Run DMC with Aerosmith and with Walk This Way. I've got Paul, I've got Mike, and I've got John in front of me. I want to talk about Spurs. Like, lots of talk recently. And you mentioned trophies before we went to the break, Mike, before 7 o'clock. And there's a lot of talk at the minute as though Champions League qualification and trophies are in opposition, as though you've got to pick one or the other. No. And to me, it's the biggest load of nonsense. The facts of the matter are literally borne out by every side that's won trophies, won more than one trophy from the last 10, 15 years.
Has also qualified for the Champions League.
Has also been quite consistently qualifying for the Champions League and has often done so for a while.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, you just almost pick up the domestic cups almost by accident, if you know what I mean. Suddenly you find you've got a good squad of players, you're interchanging them because you want to keep them fit and fresh. Before you know where you are, you're in the semi-finals of the League Cup. Yeah. And if you've still got a good squad of players, you'll manage to do that and finish top four.
It's about being able to rotate across the two things, you know, Europe and the league, and having enough resources at your disposal and not weakening yourself unnecessarily. And if you do weaken yourself, then, you know, sort of re-strengthening. And ultimately, I mean, I'll give you two sort of recent examples of where we've done that well. I mean, 2001, when we did the treble, we also came third in the league under Julio and qualified for the Champions League. The following season, we came second in the league, and we got to the quarterfinals of the European Cup, and were arguably pretty unlucky to go out. Could potentially have reached the final. And then you move that on one era into Rafa Benitez's reign, and one season apart, we did that. We competed in the Champions League and qualified quite comfortably on a number of occasions, whilst in pretty much every season bar 2006 when we went out in the last 16.
But they won the FA Cup that year.
So there's still games. I'd actually forgotten about that. Yeah. And then 2006, so we don't dispense with the European Cup, but we go out of it relatively early in February. So you make a reconcerted effort to win the FA Cup, which you do. And then 2007, we get to Athens and we finished comfortably in I think fourth that season. 2008 again, I think it's another semi-final and a third place finish. 2009 was second, we're a whisker away from the league title
and
a quarter final, and only really in the last year when we were forced into buying the likes of Sotirios Kyriakos. Are we not capable of that, and the wheels fall off in
but
that,
we also
in
still get to the semi-finals of the Europa League and only lose that in extra time. And my point on this, Paul, is that even when you're doing less well, so Manchester United the last 2-3 seasons have been doing less well, but you end up still with a bank of quality players. Not everyone leaves the minute you don't qualify or anything like that. As soon as it goes wrong, not everyone gets off. You end up still with a quality squad, and that's one of the reasons why, even though, as I say, they haven't been in the last 2 or 3 years, and obviously the other commercial revenue they get, but they haven't been regular participants in the Champions League, Manchester United. What they have been able to do is look at the players that rely on those, a lot of those players who succeeded for them under Ferguson, and still be able to go deep in competitions and remain active.
They won three cups in two seasons, United.
That's my point.
They won the FA Cup
And the Europa League,
Europa League.
Cup. I wrote something on this week, and my overall, I think some people got the wrong end of the stick of what I was saying. I think they thought I meant we should kick people on the pitch more, which I didn't. My point is, I think we're not aggressive enough as a club anymore, from top to bottom, and I include the fans in this. I think we've all become too happy. Even the six clubs into four thing, that's become a thing. Why? No one's putting Man City in that anymore. Everyone's like, well, City, and then everyone else. Well, why not us? Why not us and City and everyone else? Why are we talking about being in a fight with Arsenal for the top four? That we're not in a fight with them. Forget about them.
With you 100%.
Why are we
Mike
talking?
Was wrong before. He was wrong. Go on.
Why are we talking about anything other than looking up? I think it's sort of been fed in over a number of years now, this whole like idea that, well, you can't do this and you can't do that, and that might, I know touching on transfers, but it's absolutely ludicrous to me that as a club we're easier to tap up for our best player than RB Leipzig.
Mm-hmm.
RB Leipzig, I'd never heard of them until a year ago. Never heard of them, and we're easier to take the best player off than they are, and we already own the lad who we're trying to get. We're just, all of this feeds into the same thing of aggression. We should be doing more. We should be saying, no, we're not in a battle for the top four. We're trying to win the league. That's it. We're trying to win cups. That's it.
This is pulling it into the game, Neil, this weekend.
A polite, I mean, in what sense was I wrong?
You said that we should be winning about Arsenal, and that you did in part one.
No, I mentioned the fact that there's a battle going on.
But
for these people who fixate over fourth place.
Yeah, we're
all
together.
You were saying
that Arsenal could still finish fourth.
Of course they can.
Yeah, but they're not finishing ahead of us, Mike. They're rubbish.
They may or not be, but they.
I'm all about Kopey's aggression, Mike. Forget them. We've done them. They're finished. They're over.
Well, I'm giving you my aggression now.
Could be on this for some time.
Okay, I want to get off. Come on. Outside now, Atkinson.
What I'd say is, this is the battle we're in it with Spurs, John. And Spurs, I think, should be saying the same things that we are about looking up. They've just beaten United this week. And they've not just beaten United, but they outclassed them over the course of the 90 minutes. And we can fixate on, oh no, what's going on behind us and all of that sort of stuff. Or we can see every single game as an opportunity to look upwards. And I think that Tottenham are in a very similar boat. Around this time last season, they won 12 consecutive games. So they proved that you can do the thing even I said you couldn't do before, which is win all 10 against the poorer sides. They did it last season. And that's, I think, us and Tottenham dead interesting in this, and that we're the ones who are trying to break in to having this bank of really, really good players, so you're always reliable, you're always front foot. And I think that this game on Sunday is about that, and about who's going to do that better.
Yeah, it's a huge game of football, and it's going to be an exciting one, and I think Liverpool will play well. It'll just be, have to see kind of what Tottenham turn up, really, and the Tottenham that have generally turned up to Anfield haven't been too impressive. He is an interesting manager because he still hasn't won anything, but he's generally seen as a good manager, and kind of why not at the moment. But at some point they need to really prove, or if he feels like Tottenham's holding him back, and let's be honest, Tottenham earn £100 million less a year than Liverpool do, so if one of them is underachieving, then it's us. But if he might decide he needs to go away. But it's a talented group of players. It's a Tottenham team that the fans enjoy. But at some point, you've got to match that with silverware, and you've got to say, yeah, remember that great Tottenham team who won this, and this.
Yeah, totally. And at the moment, Spurs fans are entitled to ask the same questions as we, as Liverpool fans, should be asking.
Yeah.
You know, where's our trophies? Where's our leagues? Where's our cups? And as Gibbo points out there, we're spending more than they are.
I'm certainly earning more.
Yeah.
But how you get them is by having the bank. Because it's the last 10 years, so the period of time that you've just gone through, 15 years since 2003-04, since Abramovich comes in, who's qualified for the Champions League most often? Man United, Man City, Chelsea, Arsenal. Us, prior to to 2010, us obviously well more than Man City. Since 2010, Man City well more than us.
Yeah.
And then Spurs as well as sort of new. But it's noticeable that Man United, Chelsea and Arsenal, still winning trophies, still making finals, Paul, still absolutely doing the business. And we are entitled to say, but this is the path towards being like that, winning those trophies, is consistent top four finishes. That's the reality that we've got to deal with. We've got to consistently do this, and then we'll start doing that as well.
You and I talk a lot about this on the review, and look at Man United. I'm big on this in general life. Model excellence. If you want to do anything in your life, pick someone who's doing the thing you want to do and copy what they do. And we talk about Man City a lot, and we talk about United. You talk about Alex Ferguson. What have United done every time they've dropped out the Champions League? they've continued acting aggressively as the best club in the world. Mm-hmm. That's how they act all the time. By doesn't matter
money.
What's happening.
By spending money. Yeah. Throwing money at it.
Yeah. Because when we go, well, we're not in the Champions League, so we can't buy those players. They go, watch this. Watch what we'll do. We'll buy your best player. Watch. We're just going to buy Arsenal's best player in January when you're all talking about not being able to buy other teams' players from other teams. Crazy. They behave like the best all the time, and that's got to be the aim constantly.
And I'll tell you another, because I'm now working amongst several Manchester United fans, their fans have that same mentality as well. And, you know, it's actually quite hurtful for me to listen to it, because you actually realise, you get outside your Liverpool bubble, and you actually realise how you're perceived, and how you're perceived by your enemies, by your greatest enemy, let's face it, and actually our peers, if you like, in a battle currently for these, you know, these Champions League places. They've got a much stronger fan mentality, and that's a drop down from the mentality of their football club. And as Paul says there, they don't finish in the top four. They look at this, we're going to go out and spend £250 million. Now, the financial models of the two clubs are different. The level of spend, the potential spend is different, but there's still a principle about the way that you spend money, how aggressive you are. And as it stands, Liverpool Football Club is not being aggressive, and Manchester United continue to be aggressive.
I mean, we're 3 points behind them before we all start lauding them as this amazing achievement.
That's, you know, right.
All this money they've spent that you talked about.
And that's a perfectly valid point, John. But you know what? You'd be on a surer footing if you were saying, but you know what? We're 3 points ahead of them.
I know. Well, I mean, your point would be absolutely ridiculous
in the last two seasons.
And we haven't.
But yeah, they've won those three trophies because they've had years of Champions League qualifications, Champions League money, creating a Champions League squad. We've only managed to do it twice this decade. One of them was last year, by the way,
And as a result, as a knock-on effect, we've won bugger all as well.
And that's my point. My point is that you get the mentality by repeatedly qualifying for that tournament, and then you get the quality players, and you keep the quality players. You've got 20 of them, minimum, knocking around, and then suddenly, and before you know where you are, you're reaching semi-finals, you're reaching finals, and you're winning them. That's why you've got to focus on everything.
No, agreed, and I think to justify,
and we'll finish ahead of them as well.
Yeah, well, we may well do. Let's hope so. But I think that the point, I'm going to justify the claims of people who do fixate over finishing in the top four. But I reckon there's a justification for that perhaps they don't even get, and the justification is that is the means to actually eventually win stuff, because for all the reasons that you're stating.
Absolutely.
Having said that, I think a lot of the people that accept top four, or think that top four is the aim, don't actually have that aim about it. They're content with the fourth place. They're content with being in the Champions League. There's literally no point in being in the Champions League unless you think you can win it.
We haven't particularly benefited from it either time. They were qualified in the last 10
no,
years.
No, we haven't. But
we haven't took advantage of it. And maybe it's because it's 1 year, and I understand that. But it's not been this suddenly all these other players have opened up for us.
I think you've got to do it back to back. You've got to keep doing it, and that's why it is a massive deal. You do it back to back, and you'll absolutely kick on. And before you know where you are, so if you do it, have a decent, you scout reasonably well. You've made 9 pretty big transfers. 7 of them have come off to par or better. We're going to have to talk about the Spurs game dead quick when we've got 2 minutes left.
I was just going to say, but this is why games like Sunday are really important. You should stomp all over Spurs, because not only then are you putting your foot down in the marker for top four, you're exerting your dominance over a team that's not as good as you, a club that's not as good as you. So next time they're in the market for the same player we are, we can say they're not as good as us. Full stop. Yeah, that's it.
What's that last game between us? And the most recent sample of Spurs versus Liverpool is Spurs 4, Liverpool 1. Liverpool need to turn that on its head on Sunday.
And are we going in?
Yeah, absolutely. If the people who visit Anfield go in with the aggression and the mentality that Paul spoke of before, that every Liverpool fan that came from my era, that mentality was bred into us as supporters from our dads, and also watching that team, one of whom was Kenny Dalglish, by the way.
Karius in goal, Gomez, Van Dijk, probably Matip, Robertson, Henderson, Wijnaldum, Chan. The front three, Firmino, Salah, Mane. Anyone disputing that?
No,
I don't think we've got anyone else, have we?
Predictions, John.
Liverpool win 3-1.
Mike?
I'll go 2-1 Liverpool.
Okay, Paul?
2-1, same.
2-1, same. Everyone fancying it on Sunday against Tottenham Hotspur. They come to town. Liverpool, 4:30 on a Sunday. Should be a great atmosphere. Should be a great game. One for the Reds to get absolutely stuck into, because we should not be looking backwards. We shouldn't be tolerating Arsenal. We should only be looking upwards, and at Manchester United have proven we're the second best team in the country up the Reds.
Sports Social Podcast Network.